Thanks a lot. As always, I'm really happy to be back here. And today I'll be telling you about some joint work from a couple years ago with Daniel Person and Roberto Volpato, and some work that will appear hopefully Friday with Sarah Harrison and Roberto Volpato. So I was, you know, a little torn when I was trying to think of what I wanted to speak to you guys about, because in some sense, a lot of this work is, you know, as I said, it's something I've done a few years ago. I view it as sort of an older research program of mine. But on the other hand, we had this fantastic conference a couple days ago where there was a lot of emphasis on VOAs, which naturally appear in this story. And a second motivation is that I know this is somewhat of a mixed audience, but in particular, there's a non-trivial number of mathematicians in the audience. And when I have told them in the past that I work on moonshine and string theory, many of them have said, okay, well, I know about moonshine, but gosh, it seems like an awfully kind of strange and ad hoc thing. And a priori, because it's based on a series of weird coincidences, that's a very fair opinion. So I hope that today, in explaining to you how I think about it, using string theory as sort of a unifying or explanatory framework, that it will look perhaps a little bit more well-motivated or less ad hoc. Good. So let me start by saying what moonshine is, roughly. And this is hard to do because moonshine is not a priori a well-defined thing. There are a collection of things that people call moonshine, and it's sort of your job as the researcher to make precise what one means by that. So typically, moonshine is introduced as some kind of funny relationship between finite groups on one hand, often sporadic simple groups, though not always, and some kind of modular forms or modular objects on the other side. And I'm going to add an adjective here. I'm going to add the adjective privileged, because I think that's important for really making sense of what moonshine is. And I hope to make that clear really soon. And so the prototypical example here is the monster group. So it's the largest of the sporadic simple groups. It has about 10 to the 54 elements. And the moonshine observation here was that the modular J function, which I'll normalize in some way, modular under SL2Z, so this function J of tau, tau is defined on the upper half plane, is equal to J of minus 1 over tau, and J of tau plus 1. Well, this, if I define the variable Q, and throughout the talk Q will always be e to the 2 pi I tau, and then write down the Fourier expansion of the J function, then the first moonshine observation of Mackay in 78 or 79 is related to the Fourier expansion of just looking at the first couple terms, and let me just get the integers down. Okay, so the observation is that, well, this first non-trivial coefficient, 196884, can be written as 1 plus 196883. That's a true equation. And similarly, the second coefficient can also be decomposed in a suggestive way. And why is this any kind of suggestive way to write this thing? Well, the way I've written it, I've decomposed the Fourier coefficients into sums of non-trivial, irreducible, non-trivial and trivial, irreducible representations of the monster group. And so the moonshine observation is that this modular object somehow knows about the monster group, and that was the first moonshine-like observation. And how should you start to think about this thing? Well, I have some function. The coefficients are these beautiful integers. And ideally, if I have some function with beautiful integers that seems to be decomposing into representations of a group that I know and love, I want to categorify the statement in some sense and really view these integers as hopefully dimensions of a vector space, or more precisely, some a non-trivial module on which the finite group acts. And in the monster case, this turns out to be exactly the right explanation. That is, there exists a module for the monster group with J of tau, its graded trace. And the module was constructed by Frenkel, Lepowski, and Merman, and I'll always call it V natural. So it's a Z graded vector space. I write it as a direct sum of V sub N, and the monster group acts on each of these graded subspaces. And just let me make this slightly more explicit, J of tau can be written as the sum over the dimensions V sub N. Okay, so there was some funny observation. It turns out to be explained by a module for this finite group. The module V natural turns out to be something even nicer than you might have originally hoped. It turns out to have a lot of algebraic structure, and in particular, it's a vertex operator algebra of central charge 24. So that's nice, but it's maybe not the most exciting thing in the world. In particular, especially for the physicists in the audience, a vertex operator algebra should be thought of as a chiral conformal field theory. And you know, it's not very surprising if I give you a modular invariant partition function of some CFT that enjoys a finite group symmetry and the coefficients decompose into irreducible representations of that finite group. That's, it's maybe a little surprising that we have this beautiful chiral conformal field theory sitting here. That's very nice. It's an incredibly natural representation of the monster group, which is why people named it this. But it doesn't seem to be special yet. None of the things that I've described as moonshine make use of any sort of additional structure that would indicate that this is a special or exceptional observation. And so I want to return to this adjective privileged. In what sense should I view the modular forms that appear in monstrous moonshine as privileged? Well, first off, let me say that we started with the J function, which you can rewrite in terms of dimensions of this vertex of the graded subspaces of the vertex operator algebra. But because the monster group acts on each graded subspace, you can also naturally define a collection of functions where I just replace the dimension by the character of some element of the monster in this representation. So in other words, I can define these functions TG of tau, and these are called Mackay-Thompson series. Where now here I have the character in each VN of G, where G is an element of the monster group. So I have a whole set of class functions. And so now that I have a set of modular forms, I can tell you what I mean by privileged. And it turns out that these Mackay-Thompson series are also modular with respect to certain subgroups. Let me call them gamma sub G of SL2R. So in particular, the J function is modular with respect to SL2Z, which is, of course, a subgroup of SL2R. And these groups are special. They're called genus zero. That is to say, these objects that are modular under gamma of G, well, what do they give us? If I quotient the upper half plane on which tau is defined by this group gamma of G, suitably compactified, this space has the topology of a sphere, hence genus zero. And in particular, these Mackay-Thompson series, which are often called hauptmodulin or principal moduli, furnish a biholomorphic map between these two spaces. Or put another way, these Mackay-Thompson series are the generators of the modular functions with respect to these gamma of G, and it's only possible to have distinguished generators like this when the space is genus zero. That's when you have a distinguished generator. And I'll always normalize. So a priori, there's a little bit of a choice you can make, but I'll always choose to have zero constant term. Of course, if I added a constant term, it wouldn't affect the modularity, but for actually connecting to moonshine, it's important that all of these guys are normalized in this way. So these are called the normalized principle moduli, where you scale the coefficient to be one in front of the single pole, and you choose the constant term to be zero. So I think a lot of people have the opinion, and I do too, that if you want to call something moonshine and actually have some kind of distinguished, you know, you're hoping for some distinguished structure, you should really have something like a genus zero property, where the modular form should be privileged in some way. And people have reformulated the genus zero property to take other guises. And, you know, a priori, it's not clear which is the best formulation of this adjective privileged, especially because there are increasing examples of moonshine now showing up. And it's an open question what privilege should mean in general. But moonshine should really refer to some kind of specialness property of the functions. That's arguable, but I think it's fair. Fair to say for the purposes of this talk. So given sort of the background, let me tell you what I'm going to talk about today and what my motivation for thinking about this moonshine is at all. And so let me write some pieces of motivation. So one reason I care about moonshine sort of as a string theorist is that there have been a proliferation of things that can at least roughly be called moonshine, which is to say some kind of finite group automorphic form correspondences observed in string theoretic contexts. So there are proliferation of new moonshines, I would say both within and without string theory in recent years. And open question, what, if anything, is the unifying thread that can organize or explain these observations? And this is kind of a very mysterious question, because already when I say within string theory, well, the observations were made in the context of natural string theoretic objects. You might have heard of the Mathieu moonshine observation, which is some kind of observation related to the elliptic genus of a sigma model with target K3, which shows up in string theory, but a priori doesn't have to be related to string theory or conformal field theory on K3. So moonshine and string theory, it's sort of a thing with many examples, but without a lot of explanatory framework right now. And I would like to understand to what extent it's correct to call these observations moonshine, and what role string theory actually has to play in explaining or organizing some or all of these examples. Okay, so with that question in mind, what I'd like to do is sort of go back and explore better understood examples of moonshine, in particular monstrous moonshine, and another example called Conway moonshine, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a second, and ask, do we understand what I'll call classical moonshines? In a physical context. So for me, the classical moonshines are what are called monstrous and Conway. And by classical, I really mean we have some privileged set of holomorphic modular forms. We have a moonshine module that's a vertex operator algebra whose graded traces give us these privileged modular forms on which these groups act faithfully. And can we understand all the mathematical structures that actually appear in these moonshines in a string theoretic context? In particular, does string theory know about this genus zero property? Can it explain it? Is that actually a part of the structure that physics knows about or not? And last piece of motivation, do these moonshines give us any insight into some of the mathematical structures underlying certain string compactifications. Do these moonshines, let's just say, give string theoretic insight? Okay, so one thing I, of course, should say is that the monstrous moonshine conjectures, which in particular concern the genus zero property of these Mackay-Thompson series, have been proved. They were proved by Borchards in, I think, 92 or 93. He won the Fields Medal for it, and everyone was very happy, sort of. But there's a huge conceptual gap in the proof of Borchards, which is he verifies that the functions are genus zero by a brute force computation. So he has this beautiful moonshine module constructed by Frenkel, Lepowski, and Merman. He introduces some algebraic structures. He's able to prove genus zero, but he's able to prove it at the level of a computation. And if you want to actually understand moonshine, especially if it seems like it might be popping up in all kinds of very supersymmetric string compactifications, you would like to understand conceptually and physically, at least I want to understand physically, how this genus zero property comes about. And so the goal in these early papers with Persson and Volpato was to take the monster module, this V natural, embed it into an honest string theory, a supersymmetric string theory, and in particular we use the heterotic string, and actually provide a physics explanation of the genus zero property of monstrous moonshine, a conceptual explanation. So that's what we do in these papers. And in this work with Harrison and Volpato, we suggest an analogous story that should work for the Conway moonshine. But in the Conway moonshine, there's actually sort of a lot more to do. So this paper, I would say, is really a math paper where we go through and sort of do for Conway what Borchards did for the monster. And I'll explain what that means through the talk, but then suggest how it can also be uplifted to a full string theory compactification and where you might again hope to understand the genus zero property of Conway moonshine there. Okay, are there any questions so far about motivation? Okay, so I know this is a mixed audience, and so my aim is for both the string theorists and the mathematicians to get something out of the talk. So what I'll do is I'll treat string theory as a black box for at least a large part of the talk, and I'll hopefully say enough in words so that the string theorists will be comfortable with what I'm doing and happy with it, but also sort of just so the mathematicians can, you know, even if you're not comfortable with string theory, you can treat it as a black box, and I can make precise sort of what we proved mathematically, what we proved at a physical level of rigor, what's conjectural, and so on. And again, I would say there are a lot of this new paper that's coming out is really, really a math paper, and things are at the level of theorems. But on the other hand, it's just sort of a technical enhancement of Borchard's work. So even the things we prove are, I would say, motivated by physics. They're not introducing, you know, new mathematical structures. They're just sort of expanding a little bit on what Borchards did as appropriate. Okay, so let me give sort of the rundown of the cast of characters for this talk. So I said I'll be talking about two moonshines, and there's a different amount of work that's been done on the two sides. But these stories are quite analogous, so let me just spell out the analogy and say which aspects are due to what, what's new, what's old, and so on. Okay, so I told you about the monster. The basic object is a modular function for SL2Z, the J function. Let me write it like this. And a key piece of the story, and what was central in Borchard's proof, is that the J function satisfies a very remarkable looking identity due to originally Koike, Norton, and Zagier, Proved again by Borchards and his monstrous moonshine paper. Looks like this. Where I've defined P to be e to the 2 pi I sigma, Q is as usual e to the 2 pi I tau. Okay. So the J function satisfies this identity, and this identity is where one of the characters in the title of the talk comes in, namely the Borchards Katz-Moody algebra, or generalized Katz-Moody algebra, they're sometimes called. So this identity actually comes from the fact that there is a natural generalized Katz-Moody algebra, which is a certain infinite dimensional E algebra, on which the monster group acts, and this is its Weyl denominator identity.
What is C and M?
So M and N are just these two variables. C is the coefficient of the J function. So a priori, this...
Just a product. Hmm? Just a product.
Yeah, you multiply M by N.
Oh, that's yeah. MN, yeah. Right, so a priori, if you look at the multiplicative side of this formula, you would expect a huge number of cross terms between P and Q. The remarkable nature of the identity tells you that, in fact, it just takes the simple form where all the sigma dependents and all the tau dependents are separated in this way. And that implies a huge number of identities among the coefficients of the J function. And using these kind of identities that follow from this Weyl denominator formula, Borchards was able to just explicitly compute coefficients of the J function in the Mackay-Thompson series and show that they match the appropriate genus zero form. So that's the brute force part of the computation. And what we'd like to do is use this in string theory to find a physical explanation of genus zero without just computing these coefficients.
So M and N here are just the roots?
M and N, yeah, label the roots of...
It's a fine denominator, so then...
Yeah, you can think of the roots as labeled by M and N.
Just a pair of in Z. So the roots are just the lattice in Z2.
Yes. The string theory construction will use a family of generalized Katz-Moody algebras where the lattice is slightly more complicated.
So there's no 24 dimensional. It's not a root system in the Leech lattice.
No. I already said that we have the monster module, but just to write it again. This is sort of the central vertex operator algebraic object on which the monster group acts, and again constructed by Frank Lepowski-Merman. Should have maybe started this list a little bit higher. And there are the Mackay-Thompson series. So this you've all seen before, but I also wanted to reemphasize it because I'll put the analogous objects for Conway moonshine on the other side of the list in a second. Again, these are modular with respect to gamma G, genus zero. And the proof of genus zero by Borchards, as I said, uses the monster Lie algebra and some brute force computation. On the other hand, we have Conway moonshine. Conway moonshine starts to look slightly more complicated because we're in the monster, we had just an ordinary vertex operator algebra. On the Conway side, everything is super. And so, as people that like super vertex operator algebras knows, suddenly you have a lot more modules corresponding to Z2 twisted sectors. And things look like they're more complicated, but it's not so bad. So let me write down some functions. So here I'm writing down a modular object with respect to a congruent subgroup of index 2 of SL2Z, meaning it's invariant under SL2Z, but not tau goes to tau plus 1, only tau goes to tau plus 2. Its coefficients, again, can be decomposed into dimensions of irreducible representations of the Conway group. Okay, so I will come to that in a moment. But basically, there are two things that in the literature have been called the Conway module, VF natural and VS natural. VS natural stands for V supernatural. And I don't know why people call, I assume fermionic, VF natural. But I'll explain They're very closely related, but you have to be a little bit careful when you're talking about Conway Moonshine, and it's related to the difference between whether you have Conway Zero acting or Conway One acting faithfully on the module. So Conway One is a sporadic simple group. Conway Zero, which actually is the group that shows up in this story, is a Z2 extension of that. And well, let me not write down for the purposes of getting through the introductory part a bit faster, let me not write down all the functions, but instead just say, when you have a super VOA, I can take traces and replace them with super traces, and I can also naturally consider what are called canonically twisted modules, which for a physicist are just if I'm looking at a certain Z2 orbifold, then I look at the G twisted sector with respect to that orbifold. So for us, those would be the NS and Ramon sector. But in VOA language, you have, if you have a module for a super VOA, you also have its canonically twisted module. So I could write down a set of functions here that are both for the F natural, for the twisted module, and replace the traces with super traces. So there's naturally a family of four functions. And they all exhibit nice Conway representations. Now, what about here? Well, so this is proved in the paper that will appear in the archive later this week, hopefully, by myself, Harrison, and Volpato. We write down the natural, we construct a Lie algebra, a super Orchards-Katz-Moody algebra on which the Conway group acts faithfully, and we prove a set of denominator identities. And again, I'll just write down one because there's naturally a family. And they're easier to prove as a family, where instead of treating them as modular under this congruent subgroup, you treat them as transforming in a vector-valued representation of SL2Z instead. And it's not so hard to prove a set of these identities at once, but just for concreteness, let me write down one of them. So this one depends on eta to the 24th, the modular discriminant, and on the other side has a partition function in a twisted module of what I called V supernatural, and again, I'll say what VF natural, VS natural are. So again, there's gonna be a total of four such identities, two denominator formulas for two different algebras, and their super denominator, the corresponding super denominator.
So C means the coefficient of one of the things in the dot dot dots upstairs?
One of the things in the dot dot dots upstairs. The canonically twisted module for V supernatural, which again I'll write down in a second what is F natural, what is S natural. Essentially, they're not very different. Physically, you should think about them as just two different Z2 orbifolds of super E8, or you should think about them as start with a bosonic VOA based on the lattice D12, and extend it by, you have an option to extend it by two different fermionic modules. And one of them people have called VF natural, one of them have called VS natural. It's mostly confusion in the literature. It's not.
I think, because they're isomorphic.
They are isomorphic, except, okay, they're isomorphic as super VOAs. By super VOA, I only mean bosonic and fermionic, that there are bosonic and fermionic elements. However, there's a question of choosing a privileged n equals 1 super Virasoro algebra within the modules. And there's a subtle difference between the two if you privilege a generator, if you privilege a supercurrent and fix an n equals 1 super Virasoro. Again, these are it's nothing too bad, just technical sort of notational issues. Good. So.
Sorry, I know I keep interrupting.
That's fine. So let me just write the modules, and then, so as I said, there's two modules, which I'll say in a little bit more detail soon, VS natural and VF natural. What I would call VS natural was studied extensively in a paper by John Duncan and his student Sander Matt Crane, and what's VF natural was studied by John Duncan some years ago, and is maybe what is originally called the Conway module, but again, these distinctions are only important, really, if you're looking in the literature and trying to understand exactly what is named what and which modules you're talking about. So here on V supernatural, I would say the Conway Zero group acts faithfully. Here, I would say only the Conway One group acts faithfully. I'll get into that a bit more in a minute. Okay, and plus, of course, they're some canonically twisted modules, which I'll add a subscript TW if I'm looking at the canonically twisted modules. And in string theory, when I want to start promoting these things, the way a physicist should think about what I'm doing is that I choose VF natural to be the internal or matter part of my compactification. But when I GSO project, as I want to do if I'm building an honest string theory, then the result is that VF supernatural appears. So these things are all related by a bunch of Z2s, and the distinction is only important if you're really working through the details and are getting confused. But nothing so bad. Yeah.
So I'm sure you'll get to the Conway group eventually, but mm-hmm. if I don't choose the supersymmetry, then everything is spin 24 equivariant. All of these functions you
yep.
wrote down have spin 24, like.
Yeah.
So when are we gonna actually use the supersymmetry?
Well, when I'm building the string theory, I really want to use the supersymmetry in particular because I can realize these in string compactifications in spacetime as supersymmetric indices.
Okay.
And so I actually want to privilege a choice of superalgebra and compute a supersymmetric index with respect to these things. I turn out to get exactly the Weyl denominator formulas for the algebras. Yeah.
So even in this one, your result with Harrison and Volpato, you actually secretly chose some supersymmetry to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though like looks like there's nothing, it looks like it's just about binomial coefficients of the number 24 or something.
Yeah, no, secretly there is a privilege, supersymmetry. Which is why I'm making these distinctions between F and S natural. Otherwise, you're right. They're completely isomorphic as SVO is. Any other questions? So let me say, I'll say a little bit more about these Conway modules just because they look a bit funny and maybe that will help clear things up. But let me say the string theory sort of punchline. So again, I'll make just sort of a table of results and also some conjectures. So the full string theory uplift of this monster story, as I said, it is done and it constitutes the two papers I wrote with Person and Volpato. The work with Harrison and Volpato is really more sort of going through and doing what Borchards did for the Conway group, but I wouldn't say is a full string theory construction. So if you're a mathematician, you might have looked at Borchardt's proof and said, okay, this is really weird. It looks like he just made a string theory. And to that, well, sort of, but not really. He did something that looks kind of like a chiral string theory, but that physically is not a very natural thing. We want to actually have an honest string theory. And so the goal of the monster paper was to do exactly that for the monster case. And the Conway paper, we're sort of setting up the ingredients and sketching what would need to be done to do the full string theory also for Conway moonshine. But that is mostly deferred to work in progress. However, I can tell you what should be true and what the outcome is. So again, you can take these. Everything on this side is a physics theorem, at least. And here is, you could take it as sort of a conjecture or a sketch of what should be true. So we want to consider superstring theories, and it's natural to study the monster VOA embedded in a heterotic string compactification here, and the Conway module in a type 2 compactification here. The matter sectors, well, probably already kind of clear. But in the monster case, we want to put V natural on the bosonic or non-supersymmetric side. And on the right, well, we just want to put something of the appropriate dimensionality that's supersymmetric, as you would need for the heterotic string. And we actually choose VF natural to be the right moving piece in this compactification, mostly just because it plays the role of a nice spectator for technical reasons, but doesn't really do much that's essential in this story. And we also once we have this, want to compactify once more on a circle of radius r. So we can view the transverse spacetime of the string compactification as some 1 plus 1 dimensional string theory on a cylinder. Similarly, on this side, we'll have two copies of V, F natural on the left and right. So in particular, we're viewing these as n equals 1 supersymmetric super VOAs of central charge 12. And again, these will lead to 1 plus 1 dimensional spacetimes that we'll put on a cylinder here as well. And I'll always say the cylinder has radius r. Now, if you're building a full string theory in general, you can't just have these matter sectors. You have to get the total conformal anomaly to cancel. So here, we'll of course have some BC ghosts. And here, because we're supersymmetric, we not only have BC ghosts, but we also have a beta gamma system. Now, these are supersymmetric string compactifications. So there's some number of supercharges in this spacetime, this 1 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. And we want to compute what's called a supersymmetric index with respect to that. So here, let me just say that there's some chiral supersymmetry. The number of supercharges won't be obvious from anything I've said, but it turns out to be true. That here we have the heterotic string, so we have chiral supersymmetry. There's actually turned out to be 24 real supercharges on the right, and on type 2 we have them on both sides. It's not obvious, but if you, I can go through the details maybe afterwards. So here we want to compute some, we want to count BPS states in these models. Now in either case, if we just look at, say, the right moving supercharges, here we have 24, here we also have 24, they satisfy a very trivial superalgebra. I'm using the subscript r to denote right moving. I and j go from 1 to 24, and they just anti-commute to momenta. So this cylinder. The coordinates, if I ever write mu and nu, they're just 0 and 1. They're the space-time coordinates. So these supercharges will anti-commute to the zeroth component of the right moving momenta, also known as the energy, minus the spatial component of the momentum around the circle. And there's a delta ij. So states are BPS, or they obey a shortening condition with respect to this algebra, when these eigenvalues are equal. I'll just call the eigenvalues k0r and k1r. So the states we count here are half BPS, and the states we count here, well, they're sort of as BPS as possible. Things in two dimensions can look a little bit weird and surprising, but that's the setup. And so what are these k0r and k1r that I've written? Well, so I have string theory on a circle. I have some spatial momenta on the circle. In particular, you might expect, and this turns out to be true, that if you do things properly, the spatial momenta on this extra circle will turn out to span a unimodular lattice, even unimodular of signature 1-1, which is what appeared in Borchardt's proof, or what a string theorist would think of as light cone directions. So let me just write down that a string on a circle has left moving momentum that looks like this. R is the radius of the circle. M and N are integers. And physically, they're what are called momentum and winding numbers. Mathematically, they'll turn out to be exactly what are labeling the roots of the Monster or Conway-Lie algebras, respectively. And then you look at physical states in the string theory, which is to say states that live in the cohomology with respect to a certain BRST supercharge. And again, you can show that Borchardt's physical state condition coincides very nicely with looking at the physical states in this honest string theory. And you can do a similar thing for the Conway module, but it'll look more complicated just because you have some additional complications from supersymmetry and the beta gamma ghosts. But it's all a fairly standard exercise, I would say. So, that's the physical setup.
When you say standard, here you're compactifying time, or in the two dimensions you're compactifying. One is time, one is space. So there's something a bit more than the standard. Or am I confused there?
So far I only have space-time on a cylinder. So these are the left and right moving spatial momentum, just on the spatial circle. When I compute the supersymmetric index, what I will do is wick rotate the time direction. And so this is something standard in physics. If you want to compute a partition function, you view the theory on Euclidean time, where you identify the I'll identify.
Perspective, there's 24 dimension plus the two, so.
24 dimensional plus, yes.
26. So I'm asking about the time. What are you doing with time?
If when I compute the partition function, I'll take Euclidean time and identify.
So it's compactified.
Yes, it's compactified, but it's Euclidean time, as computing a partition function at finite temperature, as usual. So if you like here, I have some supersymmetric quantum mechanics with a lot of supercharges, and I can compute the partition function by identifying and.
So this tau and sigma, they corresponds to?
The tau and sigma in space-time will correspond to the complex and Kähler moduli of this space-time torus when I compute the partition function. Is that clear? It's okay if it's, hopefully it will be clear later when I add some more details to the picture, but that's what will happen. Any other questions?
So what exactly is the string theory setup? So you have some flat target space and then, for example, for type 2A, mm-hmm. what is the 2D Schwarzschild theory? So that's just that.
That's the internal sector, plus ghosts, GSO project, look at the sector physical states as normal, mm-hmm. and the transverse directions are this flat Minkowski cylinder.
And
then, one way that you might be happier thinking about this kind of funny matter sector, in either of these cases, heterotic or type 2A, I can think about compactifying the theory on an eight-dimensional torus. At very special points in the moduli space of this T8 compactification, namely when the metric and the B field are at very particular values, there's a factorization. The theory factorizes into the left and right moving sectors independently. And then you can take a Z2, an asymmetric Z2 orbifold on the two halves. And that's also how you can argue for what the supercharges are. Namely, the orbifold will break some of the naive supersymmetries you have from the torus, like 8, 8, but then introduce more from the twisted sectors after you orbifold 16. It introduces 16. So that's how you might think about it. You start with kind of a standard T8 compactification, tune to a very special point in the moduli space, and do an asymmetric orbifold. And you have just Minkowski.
Usually, it's not a compactification. The 1 plus 1 space should be non-compact. But in your case, that's what I'm trying to understand. In your case, the space-time is still compactified. That's where it's something new.
Right?
So it's not a standard.
I would say it's
compact and non-compact. I'm confused.
It's quite standard. I mean, I can always say, aha, instead my internal sector is times a compact boson.
No, this 1 plus 1, yeah. Sorry, the internal sector is the internal sector is a 24-dimensional. It's on one side, leech lattice, right? And then the 1 plus 1, or... I'm just asking the same thing. What is the kind of...
I think the way to think about it... So the heterotic side, yes, it looks like a leech lattice, but remember it's not... In the heterotic string, you have... gauge bosons that make the dimensionality look larger, but if you wanted to think in terms of space-time, in either of these cases, it's either the heterotic string or the type 2 string on a very special 8 torus. And then I can define a consistent compactification to Minkowski space, 1 plus 1 dimensional, non-compact if you like. But there's no additional subtlety or penalty from making the 1 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space flat of a different topology. I mean, this string theory can accommodate that by, and you could think about it as a special compactification where the internal sector is the special T8 orbifolded times a circle.
This is more supersymmetric in flat space. This is more supersymmetric in flat space.
Because of the orbifold, the asymmetric orbifold. Yeah, this is it was sort of funny. I was talking to, it's a little embarrassing if someone asks you, when you work on some theory, like how many supercharges do you have? And at some point, you don't want to say, well, I have 24 supercharges. Well, that paper isn't out yet, so maybe I can still say 24 without saying the, anyway. But yeah, that turns out to be the number of supercharges this model has, which is great because, normally I would be worried about something, physically I might be worried about this theory decompactifying on its own, but there's so much supersymmetry that I can't imagine anything destabilizing this model, so. I don't know, maybe it's heartening that it has this much supersymmetry. It's extremely protected.
And when you define the BPS sector, how many supercharges do you use to define? You just pick one?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the monster theory, yeah, I can just... in either case, this is the right moving algebra I have. In the monster theory, it's annihilated by... If I choose the shortening condition, it's annihilated. The BPS states are really annihilated by everything. Here, it's half BPS, but the right moving algebra is the same. Good. So the generalized Katz-Moody algebras, the Monster-Li algebra, say, in Borchard's proof, well, it was nice for getting these denominator identities, but physically, you would also hope it arises in a natural way. And one place you might hope that it arises is as the algebra of BPS states in this very supersymmetric string model. And in fact, Harvey and Moore introduced, or they were the ones that I think first really stressed to physicists that you should expect that BPS states themselves should form a closed algebra. And in recent years, people have made progress in understanding these algebras of BPS states as cohomological Hall algebras. But initially, in some string theory examples, Harvey and Moore looked at the OPEs of vertex operators, say on heterotic string world sheets, and found some evidence of generalized Katz-Moody structures. So you might hope that in some simple string theories, the algebra of BPS states forms the generalized Katz-Moody algebra for you. And that was when we started thinking about this, we sort of expected that would happen. The Monster-Li algebra is just the algebra of BPS states in this model, likewise for Conway, although the algebra didn't exist yet. But that turns out to not be quite true. Really what you find is that the BPS states in these models form a module over these generalized Katz-Moody algebras. And it turns out that I'm using generalized and Borchard's Katz-Moody algebras interchangeably. It turns out that you should view, and I'll explain this a little bit more in a second, you should view the generalized Katz-Moody algebra as playing the role of the spectrum-generating algebra of the BPS subsector of this theory, or as something like a spontaneously broken gauge symmetry algebra in this model.
Sometimes you can see symmetries in the theory as operators of those numbers 0,1, 0. It's not usually... The Vicker states to string theory because number one and
yes.
One of them.
Yeah, and that's all we look at here.
But sometimes symmetries appear as because number zero and one.
Mm-hmm.
So you get things that can be integrated along cycles on the worksheet to act on physical states.
Good.
It's rare, but I think interdimensional.
It might be exactly the place where this would happen. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's I'm not sure if that's true here, but
like these supercharges, right? Supercharges themselves can be found like that on the worksheet.
Yes, the zero momentum limit of this. Yeah.
Yeah, you can really find some 1,0 because something was number 1 and 0.
Yes.
So maybe there are many more here.
That's possible. Let me think. Well, one thing I can say is that Okay, you're good. This is a good point. You only get the Borchardt-Katz-Moody algebra of Borchardt and us if you decouple, if you avoid that sector, because there we can actually prove that we have the generalized Katz-Moody algebra for the fixed, the usual ghost number, physical ghost number. But I think it's possible that the symmetry could be enhanced if we look at zero ghost number instead. But it's not obvious to me. Yeah, I think it would take a little bit of working out. It's not clear that it will happen here, but it might. Good. In fact, one open question that I want to know is, can the GKM actually be upgraded to some kind of Hall algebra, like the usual proposal of the algebra of BPS states? And maybe this is the place to look for that to happen.
Definitely have a formal algebra.
Yes. I'm just trying to think if there's any... this model has a lot of slight subtleties, and I'm trying to think if there's any obvious obstruction to doing what you say, but I don't think there is in this case. Maybe one should look there. Okay, well, let me just see how. Oh! I should. Okay, let me give some punchlines for what happens with the algebra of BPS states. If you're interested in the details, I can tell you more after, because I want to at least get to the sketch of the genus zero property of monstrous moonshine from physics. And if I had time, which I don't think I will, I can. One of the things that I can do is to start to translate some of the string theoretic ingredients of the proof back into the language of vertex operator algebras. So I think I'm optimistic that our physics proof, which is, I think, quite conceptual, can actually admit a vertex operator algebraic proof. But I think I won't have time for that. But if you're interested, I can go over that sort of after the talk. So let me just say some punchlines about the Borchardt-Katz-Moody algebras and the algebras of space-time BPS states in this model. Let me be very brief. So I already told you that these denominator identities are Weyl denominator identities for generalized Katz-Moody algebras. And I told you that the BPS states in these theories form a module over the algebra. In fact, they form a very nice one. Wedge G plus, where G plus are the positive roots of either the monster or the Conway-Lee algebra, depending on the context. This wedge is just the alternating sum of exterior powers as usual. And let me call the monster-Lee algebra this script M. The monster group really acts on these guys. So if G, or the, actually, I should say G. To be consistent. If G were an ordinary Katz-Moody algebra, it's known that wedge G plus is always a module for the algebra, and in particular, the highest weight, it's a module with highest weight, the Weyl vector, and then the virtual graded character of this module gives you the Weyl denominator identity. For a Katz-Moody algebra, that's known to be true. For a generalized Katz-Moody algebra, it's not known whether it's true in general, but in the paper with Persona and Volpato, we proved that it's true for the monster-Lie algebra, but we had to use some very specific facts for this algebra. So in general, I don't know if it's true, but here, the space-time BPS states. Just form this wedge G plus, and the supersymmetric index therefore naturally localizes on this graded character. And when I say graded, I mean in gamma 1-1 graded virtual module. Last week I was at a talk by Kevin where he had some algebras of BPS states that were sim G plus. Here I have wedge G plus just because in low dimensions my BPS states are always fermionic. And the monster-Lie algebra acts naturally on these things. Great. And I should say also, and this was used in the proof of Borchardt's, that the Weyl denominator formula admits sort of a homological upgrade, where the multiplicative side is wedge G plus. And again, it really looks like a fermionic Fock space. And in the string theory, that's just exactly what it is. You build a Fock space of these BPS states, and you find this for the index. And the additive side, what would give you something like the J sigma minus J tau, is given by the Lie algebra homology of G plus. And you can compute that side within physics too and actually get the additive form, but I don't have time for that. So let me skip it. Oh, but in particular, if you have, given this wild denominator identity, you have these GKM actions on both sides, then you can start from an identity like this and replace the graded dimensions with characters and prove a set of twisted denominator identities where the things on the right-hand side look something now like TG of sigma minus TG of tau, the Mackay-Thompson series. And again, Borchards used these identities to do a brute force computation of monstrous moonshine. And in the Conway case, we use the same kind of idea to prove a whole set of twisted denominator identities for the Conway algebra also. Good. Okay. So I could say much more about how we construct the algebra from vertex operators and so on, but let me not do that in the interest of time. Let me just say one more word about the comparison of Borchardt's construction to a full string theory, and then I want to say something very, if I can, maybe I'll, if I'm allowed 10 minutes or so extra, depending on the patience of the audience then. I want to say how we prove genus zero.
Can I ask a string theory question?
Yeah.
So why are there two parameters in the BPS algebra, sigma and tau? Thank you. Isn't it bigraded?
Well, so the algebra is naturally constructed as, it's a rank two. The Cartan is rank two, but in string theory, it comes from just the momentum and, one way to say it is that the algebra is spanned by momentum and winding quantum numbers in string theory, if you like. And the sigma and tau are, again, when I compute the partition function, I identify, I make a torus of, let's say, S1 of radius beta inverse temperature times S1r. But in general, I can think of sigma and tau as parameterizing the Kähler and complex moduli of that torus. And when I compute the supersymmetric index, I want to grade by the total momentum and winding number of the strings. And so both of those variables should appear. Does that answer?
So here I'm confused again. You have two circles.
Yes.
So the winding and momentum is with respect to one circle. So what about the other circle? And then you must have some kind of theory.
Yes.
So why is there only one momentum and one winding since you have two circles? Good.
Yeah, when I compactify this direction and pass to the torus, I will indeed consider a lattice. I will consider momentum and winding on all of the cycles, but in general, there's no non-trivial winding on this time direction. But yes, there's this Euclidean torus has some winding and momentum lattice that's just four copies of Z. Mm-hmm. I'm about to get more intricate lattices for when I prove genus zero. I'll explain where those come from. But you're right that at this point, I do have a two-dimensional. I have four. I have four integers.
So to get to two, you do.
In string theory, I have Mashal and level matching conditions that help me. But
the on-shell conditions what is the string interpretation of?
So what I was about to write down might answer your question. So let me do that, and then we can come back. Okay. So again, yeah, I want to say just a couple more words about Borchardt's construction versus the full string theory, and then I want to talk about genus zero. So Orchard's considered some product VOA that was V natural times the lattice vertex algebra based on the even unit modular lattice of signature 1-1. And he defined some BRST-like charge, I'll call it BRST sub Orchard's, and looked at the physical states with respect to this charge, and built the Monsieur-Lee algebra and so on. So in string theory, I have this more elaborate internal sector. In particular, I can construct the usual BRST cohomology in string theory, which is a sum of left and right moving directions. So Borchardt's was purely chiral. I'm not chiral. So I have two natural BRST. I have the string theory BRST charge. It has an holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic piece. If I impose level matching and the right moving mass shell condition, the result, which I will assert, but it's a couple extra lines that I just won't take the time for, forces the left moving momentum, what I would call K0L and K1L, to take values in a lattice that's isomorphic to gamma 1. And then Borchardt's physical state condition is nothing but the physical state condition, Borchardt's physical state condition is nothing but the remaining left-moving mass shell condition that I had yet to impose. So left-moving mass shell, Borchardt's condition. Okay. I had wanted to say some words about why I interpreted the algebra as I did as some kind of spontaneously broken gauge algebra, but if you're interested, I would just say, let's maybe ask me after the talk, just so I have time to get to genus zero. Okay, let me get to genus zero now, and in particular, we'll see sort of the full winding and momentum lattice and the role that plays. So, what do we do to prove genus zero, the genus zero property of monstrous motion? Well, so I told you that I computed the supersymmetric index in this model and I got the J function, or this denominator identity for the J function, J of tau minus J of sigma. But if I wanted to get the genus zero property for all of the Mackay-Thompson series, it looks like I need to do something else. And the most natural thing to do, it turns out, is to consider a set of orbifolds of this theory. So why do I want to do this thing? Well, so these genus zero groups are genus zero with respect to some subgroups of SL2R. I have a chiral conformal field theory. So that already you should think, well, that must give us most of the modularity. And indeed, for the subgroups of gamma naught of G, typically they're congruent subgroups of the form gamma naught N, roughly speaking. Those subgroups that are further subgroups of SL2Z are naturally explained by conformal field theory. But conformal field theory is never going to give me some of the transformations in gamma of G that are in SL2Z or in SL2R but not in SL2Z. In particular, maybe the most famous class of such transformations that I need to include in these groups to get genus zero are of the form, say, tau goes to minus 1 over n tau, where n is the order of g. So these are called Fricke involutions in the literature. And there's a more general class of such things that are called Atkin-Lehner involutions. And in fact, roughly speaking, and let me be a little bit rough just for the purposes of this talk, but it's all carefully done in the paper, you can get the genus, you can generate the appropriate genus zero groups, gamma sub g, by adjoining to these simple congruent subgroups that follow from conformal field theory or VOA, a certain subset of Atkin-Lehner involutions. So this piece we know, and these involutions from conformal field theory we don't know. So we want to use string theory to actually get these genus zero groups honestly and really explain the Hopped module property that way. And these transformations that look like this, these Fricke involutions, or more generally, the Atkin-Lehner involutions, they are known to arise, as t-dualities in certain orbifold models. In fact, they're known to arise as t-dualities in orbifold models that look exactly like the setup I have here, some internal sector times a circle. And you can what you do then, and what we did in the paper, is say, well, let's consider the class of models. So I have my left and right moving sector in my circle. Let's consider an orbifold by some symmetry G of the monster group and some extra symmetry delta. So G, just the orbifold by G, just acts on V natural, nothing else. It's the orbifold CFT, so G in the monster. And then delta is a shift. It's you're orbifolding just the circle factor, and you orbifold by a shift of 1 over nth of the period of the circle. So
the circle is the circle you compactified on, or was it something else?
Yeah, the same, that circle. So in particular, where in a momentum winding lattice on the torus, I just had four copies of Z, now I'm going to get fractional winding and more interesting lattices. And I have to ask, what are the automorphism groups of these lattices? In particular, they furnish the t-dualities of my model. So I have to compute the automorphism groups for this class of orbifold theories. You look unhappy. No. Another reason you want to do this.
I'm so happy, and I can ask you questions later.
So. Sure. Another reason you want to do this is because you can't you can't make a consistent CFT orbifold by any element of the monster group that you want. You encounter failures of level matching in the twisted sector. Though I won't do it in this talk, but again, I can talk to you after if you're interested in. This circle factor allows you to repair those bad orbifolds and construct a consistent orbifold for every conjugacy class of the monster group, even the ones that if you just had V natural on its own and you were trying to orbifold it, you'd find an inconsistent theory. But the circle allows you to
by translation, by combination of translation and winding.
Sorry?
In those cases, you use combinations of translation and winding that have anomalies.
Yes, yes. Or the kind of a fast way to think of it, though it amounts to exactly what you said, is that rather than orbifold by 1 over n, if I have some anomaly lambda, like some multiplier in the partition function, or I can kind of, it turns out that all I need to do is make this 1 over n lambda. And it's not obvious that that
sorry,
really works, but it works.
SL2Q.
Sorry?
Are your gamma g's always in SL2Q? Are they always rational?
Oh.
Are always maybe for
g of 1 and g of 2z? Maybe g of 2z?
Well, I'm wondering if they can ever be like numbers that are rational. Or is it just some denominator you're adding on by these other conditions?
In general, they're more complicated.
So,
arithmetic? Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They're commensurate with SL2s.
Maybe question/comment. So you didn't tell us which heterotic here, and is that because this t-duality is kind of, you're hiding that, basically, and that's how you go outside of the modular group?
I'm an E8 times E8 heterotic. The t-duality is... Well, it's very important, but it doesn't quite do what you said. But I'm about to get to what it does. Hopefully, as quickly as possible without losing clarity. Let's see. Okay, so I have this orbifold, and I get a new set of denominator identities. I get wild denominator identities for new generalized Katz-Moody algebras, in particular ones that were constructed by Scott Carnahan when he proved generalized monstrous moonshine. But they're not the identities used by Borchardt's, which would just be take all the dimensions and put G insertions in all of the traces. They're more intricate than that. They're denominators for generally new algebras. And we can construct those algebras again as the BPS states form the same kind of module over those algebras in the orbifolded theory. All of the same stuff goes through. But on the other hand, when we derived these denominator identities physically, we got them from a supersymmetric index. And a supersymmetric index had better be invariant under the duality group of the theory. And here, because I have lattices of momentum and winding, the t-duality group should be the automorphism group of the momentum and winding lattice of my theory. Now, just because I have some automorphism of the lattice and it's a T-duality group, that doesn't mean it's a group of self-dualities. As we saw in very similarly to what Davide taught us in the conference, in general, you can apply these duality transformations, but it takes you to very different perturbative descriptions. And in particular, I need not land on the same theory that I started with. In particular, V natural, this orbifold CFT, will be isomorphic to V natural if the duality is a self-duality. But in general, I won't land. I'll land on some other CFT, and in particular, I'll land on some other string theory that's constructed from this guy. And I'll get a whole new Orchard's-Katz-Moody algebra. I'll get a different set of BPS states. And so if I really want to look at invariance properties of the supersymmetric index, I had better isolate the group of self-dualities from these, from the full group of T-dualities. And it turns out that if I do that, well, so these denominator identities, they should be some subgroups. So being kind of rough, my denominators are automorphic forms with respect to some subgroups of this O22, which I split like this. Let me call the automorphism of the momentum and winding lattice O of gamma. And I look at the subgroup that's the group of self-dualities. Let me give this a name and call it gamma of G. So gamma of G is some subgroup of SL2R times SL2R. And I do the analysis carefully, and I find that the projection of this subgroup of self-dualities onto the first SL2R factor gives exactly the groups of monstrous moonshine. That is, in addition to these gamma naught of n's that are obvious from CFT and I basically get for free, to get a self-duality, I have to adjoin exactly the subset of Atkin-Lehner involutions that would generate precisely the genus zero groups of monstrous moonshine. So that tells me what these functions are modular with respect to, but I haven't told you why the groups are genus zero. Now, if I have a modular function that's invariant with respect to some modular group that I'm calling gamma of G, if I can show that that function is a Hopped module, or this principal module as the generator for the group, then that implies that the group is genus zero, because the module, a modular group is genus zero if and only if it has this principal modulus. So since I'm running out of time, let me just kind of state the punchline for what the idea is. So the idea is to get the Hopped module property. So let me give you the sketch, and then I'll conclude. So first, what we do is reformulate the Hopped module property. It's equivalent, if I want to show that this guy is a Hopped module, it's equivalent to it's equivalent to the property that this function has a single pole as tau goes to I infinity, and the images of the pole under the duality under the modular group gamma of G, and no other poles. So that's equivalent to the Hopped module property, and that's the version that we prove physically. So equivalent to single pole, only at tau goes to I infinity in the duality images. In the case of SL2Z, there's only one cusp that's not identified. It's just this one. In general, there are more. And at the level of this supersymmetric index, these denominator identities, well, I've written them, say, as TG of capital T minus TG of U. I haven't written the twisted versions, but let me write them like this. So it turns out that I get the Mackay-Thompson series here, minus not the Mackay-Thompson series, but the G-twisted partition function. If I took the orbifold of V natural by the cyclic subgroup generated by G, and I looked at the partition function of the G-twisted sector, this is what shows up here. So these are the denominators for generalized Katz-Moody algebras constructed by Carnahan. So in this language, this is nothing but the statement that this supersymmetric index, let me call it Z sub G of T and U, has a single pole as tau goes to I infinity with U fixed and nowhere else up to dualities. But now, it's essentially trivial to get that, as I said, we always have these gamma naught of n subgroups. We get those for free. So all we really need to do is check the Atkin-Lehner involutions. That is to say, we want to check that the supersymmetric index, Zg, say, as a function of t, but at u fixed, diverges at a cusp of h mod gamma naught of n, compactified, if and only if the cusp is related to I infinity by an Atkin-Lehner involution in gamma naught of g. So we rewrote the Hopf module property in this kind of language. And the moral of the story, well, the moral of the story can also be stated quite quickly. So I have these T and U. They're the complex and Kähler moduli of this torus that looks like this. For simplicity, let me just say that I only have an imaginary part of each of them. Let me write them explicitly as beta times R over N up to some normalization. N, again, is the order of G by which I'm orbifolding. R on the bottom. So what we do is essentially use some dualities to map the behavior of this function as t approaches a cusp to some more general function as u goes to infinity at fixed t. That's an interpretation issue just because, you know, as t and u go to infinity, then I can interpret these things as either large radius or small radius limits of the spatial circle. So I want to be able to always switch to a duality frame where I can actually make some physical sense of what I'm counting and what the partition function is. In particular, I always want to stay in a regime of very low temperature, which beta is the inverse temperature. So I always want to keep beta much greater than 1 and then look at the model as I shrink or grow the spatial circle. And, well, if I stay at low temperature, then physically that means the ground state is the dominant energy state in the partition function, something like beta R. So as T goes to I infinity, R is getting huge, and I have my single pole. Now, if I keep the temperature very low, and I instead am shrinking the circle, taking this U goes to I infinity limit, and I stay in the low temperature region the whole time, if this is still the dominant state at low temperatures, the function clearly doesn't diverge. The only way I get a divergence in this duality frame is U goes to I infinity, which again is just exactly the behavior as T approaches these cusps that I want to investigate. The only way I get divergence is if there's a phase transition in the model. In other words, I need a new ground state to come in and dominate at small radius. Otherwise, I'll never get a single pole. Now, it turns out that we can prove this phase transition happens at some critical value of the radius. At this critical value of the radius, I can show that the algebra gets an enhancement by an SU2 Katz-Moody algebra. It turns out that I can identify this SU2 enhancement with exactly the normal gauge enhancement in string theory that I see at a critical value of the radius when I'm doing a T-duality. again, in string theory, this enhanced SU2 always contains a Z2 subgroup that's the usual Z2 t-duality, the R goes to 1 over R transformation. In these more exotic duality frames, this involution looks less like the usual t-duality, but it is. It just looks like an Atkin-Lehner involution. So I have this enhanced gauge symmetry that contains my t-duality, and I can use this to show that I get this if and only if I'm at, even only if my self-duality group contains this Atkin-Lehner involution. To put it another way, algebraically, I have two real simple roots in my monster Lie algebra, and I've chosen some basis such that I've fixed a G plus. I've chosen a Weyl chamber. What the model is telling me is that when I hit this critical radius and I go past, my choice of real simple roots switches. In other words, t-duality is nothing but Weyl reflections in the algebra. This only happens when I have self-dualities, because otherwise it turns out that I have, that the other algebra that I could access by t-dualities is an algebra with currents, and I would never get a divergent pole if I was looking at that algebra. It turns out I get it if and only if the model contains the Atkin-Lehner involution that's a subgroup of my enhanced SU2 as a self-duality. And using this, we can prove that an orbifold of V natural with respect to G is isomorphic to V natural under exactly that condition, when we have this Fricke involution or Atkin-Lehner involution as a self-duality in this theory. So the punchline is the genus zero groups are t-dualities. The Hopf module property can be inferred from the enhanced gauge symmetry of string theory at a critical radius when I'm doing a t-duality. And this gives me exactly the Hopf module property. I have a pole when I'm at these cusps, if and only if the Atkin-Lehner involution is in the self-duality group, and there I can show that the models are equivalent. So I'm sorry, that might not have been as clear as I wanted because I was rushing a little bit, but. And I should also say that this enhanced SU2, we're able to sort of start to translate into a vertex operator algebra language. So I expect it to be amenable to a rigorous proof, I hope, not just t-duality string theory arguments. And I can give you the translation afterwards. Okay, so let me stop here.
I'm sure there are more questions because I have many. But more questions, so feel free to escape if you have to.
Yeah, you made a couple of suggestions that this might be linked to Harvey and Moore's work.
Yes.
Is there anything concrete to say? Is there any like GP or four dimensional leaps n equals two things coming up?
Yeah, well, I think there's a big open question of what is the type two dual of this funny model. And I hope that would have a direct relation to Harvey and Moore's work. It's very hard to find a type 2 dual for this model because there's no moduli. So any type 2 compactification, and that follows from the fact that there's no currents in V natural. It only is acted on by a finite group symmetry. The orbifold kills all the currents, and that translates to no massless moduli in string theory. So a type 2 dual, which I hope would exist and would be very interesting, has to look very funny. I have to do some kind of non-geometric orbifold to kill all the moduli in such a thing as well. So Harvey and Moore, so they wanted to actually find the algebra of BPS states and suggested that it should be, say in this kind of a context, a generalized Katz-Moody algebra. It should have been the monster Lie algebra. That's not actually the case here. So I would say it's a question of what is the actual algebra of BPS states in this model, and how does it square with the proposal of Harvey and Moore? Proposal is kind of a strong word. They emphasize that there should be an algebra of BPS states. In some examples, it looked quite like a generalized Katz-Moody algebra, but it's hard to make precise. And you would hope, the arena in which you would hope to make it precise is by actually computing OPEs of vertex operators in the heterotic string. And we do that here, and we find not the GKM itself, but a module over the GKM. So yeah, I would like to know what the honest algebra of BPS states is in this model. Maybe Davide's suggestion is the way to really get it from his earlier question.
Mm-hmm. So if I take any finite group at all,
yes,
any class and any class in H4, any sort of that I want to set to be the attempt anomaly.
Yeah.
Then I can find a bosonic vertex algebra with a faithful action of that group and where the anomaly is that class. That's known. So, but I won't get any of the good properties. So where in your story did it break?
That's a good question. So the anomaly, like the H4 class, I would expect to see in this setup. What I should be doing, I think, is looking at...
I could have even asked it without the anomaly. Any finite group acts non-anomalously, faithfully, on some holomorphic vertex algebra.
Yes.
So, like, that's a stupid construction. You just take, like, a humongous product of the monster theory, and you just do the permutation action.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't expect any genus zero anything.
Hey, you cannot do string theory with that.
I don't know what it means to do string theory.
So yeah, I guess the black box has some input specifications that I didn't give you at the beginning of the talk. I would say you can't do string theory on this. But of course, you could ask, given some other consistent model on which you can do string theory, it would be nice to have sort of a deeper reason for why this phase transition argument, like looking at the decompactification limits and failing to find genus zero. I mean, that you should readily see, but I guess it would be nice to formulate that failure for general compactifications in a more satisfying way. But here I'm able to do it because essentially in the moduli space, I only have two non-trivial cusps, roughly speaking, or in other words, only two non-trivial algebras show up. So in a perturbative duality frame, if I choose a perturbative duality frame, I only have two options for what kind of model I get. It'll either be something based on V supernatural, which we proved it will either be something that's isomorphic to V supernatural, or V supernatural mod G is not isomorphic to V supernatural, but is isomorphic to the Leech VOA. And then the algebra has currents, and I fail to get the divergences where I need them to be, et cetera. So in that case, this is nice because I can really make everything precise. There's so few sort of non-trivial perturbative duality frames in some sense. And part of that is because this model has no moduli. So all I can do is kind of make the circle bigger or smaller. That was a long-winded way of saying, even if I could do string theory, I'd like to have a better way of phrasing the punchline.
One other naive question, which was at the very beginning, sort of a while ago, you said you were going to do this, like, you put the monster theory as your left movers, and then you just sort of declared, I want to study the monster theory, and I'll decide that my right movers are going to be this this sort of supernatural or fermionic natural object.
Yeah.
How, like...
Did I motivate that?
Yeah, was that just some arbitrary, I like this one, or was it, like...
No, it's actually, it's very useful, also because it has no moduli. That's the reason it's nice, and then I can translate that into a couple statements. But essentially, it helps me land on the denominator identity on the nose. All it can do is contribute Ramond ground states to the supersymmetric index.
So for instance, instead there's a sequels 24 n equals 1 object, and the paper's called something like supersymmetry in the beast. You probably know this object.
Yes.
Could I have used that instead?
Well, not in the heterotic strain, because remember I'm on an 8 torus. Only the left movers sort of get to have the extra central charge.
Okay.
So no, I can't use that. I could have used the E8 lattice, but then I'd have moduli, and I don't want to do the analysis on that model. It would get very it would get complicated.
Other questions?
Let's thank Natalie.